Show Me the Way, Episode 11, The English Valuator. You like that, Steve? A little different approach. This episode, we're going to talk with Steve York of Stern Brothers about his life experience, including his involvement with the valuation business and as well his involvement in the buying or selling of businesses. Welcome to Show Me the Way, a podcast presented by Spencer Fain, LLP, about business succession planning, the merger and acquisition experience, and successful exits. I'm your host, Dave Sider. Joining me on today's show is Steve York, who I've known for years. Steve is one of the partners at Stern Brothers. Steve is going to share his secrets as a valuation professional. Steve, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Dave.
If we could start, Steve, a little bit, give us a flavor of your background. And I mean all the way back. I mean going back to the UK. Let us get to know Steve a little bit, please.
I believe there's a mathematical answer to everything. If I didn't work as a valuation analyst, I'd probably be a doctor doing gene therapy.
I believe you.
And I think either one of those careers would be just fine.
So you're born and raised in Kansas City, went to high school here in Kansas City?
Well, born in Britain.
Right.
And got to Kansas City before I started school, which was probably helpful. My parents still had to send me to speech therapy to learn how to speak American.
Oh, wow.
And so yeah, I started out my career at PricewaterhouseCoopers in St. Louis after college. From there, I had a controllership for a publicly traded company here in Kansas City. That company was bought by a larger competitor. And then I went to work for Sears in Chicago. And I really enjoyed my career there. But that's where I got started after going through the process of assisting with the sale of the publicly traded company here in Kansas City. When I was with Sears, we would acquire 20 to 30 companies a month.
I did not know that. Wow.
And, you know, in that process is where I got inculcated, if you will, into the norms, standards, you know, how people approach acquisition and disposition of companies. You know, and at the time, Sears owned Allstate, owned Dean Witter, you know, Coldwell Banker Real Estate.
God, I forgot that.
And in total, I was their chief accounting officer. I had to consolidate 2,234 companies every month.
Oh, my Lord.
And it was a great experience. That number of companies always changed depending on acquisitions. We had some brilliant minds in acquisition, not the least of which was Phil Purcell, who went on to become the chairman of Goldman. But I learned a lot in that process. And between that and working in public accounting, I decided that I would go with companies that were interested in either acquiring or be acquired. And so I took a couple of additional CFO jobs with that in mind, either that the company was going to move up or move out. And I have just really enjoyed that process. I think the key underlying factor in connecting with a particular job is that you don't feel you have Mondays because you love it. But secondly, it fits your personality. And my personality is such that even though I like statistical analysis, and I do believe numbers tell the truth and people don't, I can still talk to people. Better yet, I can listen.
I will verify that for the people in the audience listening in. Tell us a little bit about Stern Brothers. How did you get over there? And what do you do for Stern Brothers, please?
I joined Stern Brothers after I decided I could do more good assisting with clients purely in the area of valuation. One of the concerns with mergers and acquisitions is you have to convert everything of one of the companies. You have to convert payroll, fringe benefits, compensation structures, everything in the acquired target company has to be adjusted. And I don't mind doing that four or five times in my life, but I don't want to do it all the time. I found it kind of boring. So I joined a couple of decades ago, Stern Brothers, and now I have the opportunity to work on between 225 and 250 transactions a year. Stern Brothers is 105 years old. It specialized in underwriting bond issues, and it has been very successful. Back in 1996, Stern Brothers Valuation Advisors split off from Stern Brothers and Company, thinking maybe that doing valuation for your own employer lacked independence. And
sorry,
it was probably
laugh.
A clever yeah. thought on our part. But since 1996, Stern Brothers Valuation Advisors has been separate from Stern Brothers, the bond underwriter.
You know, one of the first things that I do in about any transaction, and I'm talking about buying or selling businesses, is to ask people what they think a business is worth. I mean, I actually have software and a checklist that I go through to look at all the variables. But invariably, one of the biggest questions I ask people is, what is their business worth? And I get a variety of answers. And sometimes they will have contacted someone like yourself to get that valuation done. But I would say that's probably maybe 50% of the time that that's true. Let me ask this question to start with. When, if someone is looking at a transaction, when should they start thinking about contacting you for evaluation?
There are many different fingers in this pie.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And, you know, as you and I have worked together historically over the past couple of decades, and even before in the Alliance of Merger and Acquisition Advisors, we may be representing the buy side, the sell side, the banker, somebody that's holding a financial interest in the company individually, or a debtor to the company. And that creditor's looking to be cleaned up, if you will, for one reason or another. Last but not least is we often are hired by an executor of an estate, because maybe a substantial shareholder or an even insubstantial shareholder may have passed, and those shares aren't terribly liquid all the time. We do some work with publicly traded companies, but it's a much, much larger market working with privately held companies. Yeah, I recently made a presentation in a corporate law class at KU Law School, and I'm always amazed by what tickles the fancy of young people going through an education program. But I was asked, you know, what do I think about the dark market?
Wow.
And the answer is that almost every transaction we've ever worked on is not publicly traded and is dark, you know, within the sense of how that student was asking about it in the corporate law class. I think people don't understand how you create value with ownership of a business, whether it's publicly traded or not. And so back to your original question, an owner ought to become familiar with the terms, standards, and procedures of valuing their company. But stepping back from that, I always appreciate when an owner lets me talk with them a little bit, because those owners are out there churning and burning, worrying about covering next week's payroll. They're doing everything they can to minimize their income tax exposure. They're taking care of claims, or if a lawsuit pops up, it just overwhelms them. And because of that, often their financial statements are not very well presented. They're presented more from a defense of cash approach than they are from a generally accepted accounting approach that a potential buyer or the due diligence team for the buyer would understand. So what are some common problems a potential seller has Well, the biggest one is inconsistent accounting. And here in 2020 and 2021, we've had a big dollop of inconsistent accounting with the grant programs for the employee retention tax credit and with the payroll protection program, PPP money. Those are government grants that nobody particularly expected. They came in multiple waves. The accounting for them has been all over the map. The result for most sellers is that they've ended up with way too much cash on their balance sheet, and they haven't taken it out. You know, they have a unique situation where they don't perceive that money as earned money that they should be distributing to the shareholders in order to cover income taxes. And in our opinion and experience, cleaning up those financial statements so that they're consistent, that they're GAAP, and that a potential buyer would respect the statements as fairly presenting what they can expect if they were to buy that company.
Really appreciate that. And as you always say, people don't buy cash for cash at the end of the day. Clean out your bank account. Now let's flip it to the buy side. You're doing a valuation on the buy side. You got a different hat. I think people think that valuation is valuation. It's just not accurate. Let's go to the buy side. How do you handle that type of representation as a valuation expert?
Our number one charge is to figure out how long it's going to take for an investor to get their money back. You know, investors like return on their money, but they're really a lot more worried about return of their money.
Of the money.
And so when we're on the buy side, we're going to look at quality of earnings. We may work with an outside CPA that will go through and see how much of their earnings could be taken out. We will look at what the tax exposure is going to be, because it doesn't matter if it's an S corp or an LLC or a partnership with flow through income, somebody's still paying the tax. And we're going to look at what the risks may be. You know, an interesting trend lately in the M&A market is that warranties and representations on claims,
right,
sometimes the limits would be set at like 40% of the transaction price. You know, those limits have come way down to where now we expect them to be less than 20%. But our job as assisting buyers has to be to weigh risks, tell the buyer what similar risks have sold for in the market based upon our experience. And we're going to look at guideline transactions. We're going to look at future discounted cash flows and assign a probability that those cash flows will be achieved. And we're lastly going to talk about different deal structures, because up until recently, you would see maybe 40 or 50% cash down, 50% earnout of some sort or another, and then some sort of equity participation in NewCo. Well, the equity participation has pretty much come to a screeching halt. And, you know, it was a hot thing to have 5 years ago, but those days are gone. But on the earnouts, buyers still like to have that so that the sellers have risk. But we've gone back more to a familiar structure of using seller notes.
Yes.
Where the seller takes back paper, because yes, bank financing has become very hard to close. You know, banks are interested. They'll treat you nicely. They'll buy you lunch, but you'll play the dickens closing that loan. And it's a lot more expensive now than it was even last year. So when we look at seller notes, a problem that was fairly common, way too common 10 years ago, is that a seller would take back a seller note for 10 years, and whoever the buyer was would sell the company after 4 or 5 years, and the seller note would not be retired. The seller would be stuck with somebody they don't know, somebody for whom they have no credit qualifications for, and somebody they may really not like, owing them their payments of $500,000 every quarter. And that can leave the seller in a very difficult situation. And it gets even worse if the seller passes away during that seller note period. So with those in mind, one of the things that we like to talk with buyers about is how deals are typically being structured, and talk through with them some of the things they ought to consider as pluses and minuses to discuss as deal points with that potential seller. One of the techniques that we see coming back, and it was very popular 15 years ago, is for investors in a company to use a preferred stock structure. And we didn't see that for a long time. I mean, maybe from 2010 to a couple years ago, you just wouldn't see preferred stock. It adds a level of complexity. People can have misunderstandings on how that works, particularly if there's a change in control. And then last but not least is we still see people interested in having warrants involved. And particularly if the seller note maybe carries a 5% interest rate, maybe there'll be warrants issued so that at the end of some time period, there's a possibility to earn another 5% or so on the notes taken back. But generally, equity participation is off the table because nobody wants it. Sellers of a company make very poor middle managers. And so, you know, we see the employment agreements, they're getting more attention now if they're going to retain existing owner / management, say for a 3-year period, or even if they're not going to retain them and do a non-compete agreement. Those agreements are getting a lot more attention right now.
I have to tell you and share with the audience, this is what I enjoy talking to Steve about, because it transcends what people perceive as valuation. And what is significant is to find someone who, yeah, they can value the business, but they can give you the ins and outs of where transactions. A lot of people in this profession don't do it, they don't know how to do it, they're not sure that they should do it. And this is a differentiator that I've found over the years that Steve brings to the table. And more importantly, some of the things that he has hit on, I am seeing now with the transactions I am doing today. So Steve, you're up to date. Thank you for sharing at that level. And, you know, I think that should be hopefully very meaningful in how the differences there exist for sellers versus buyers. Let's talk about lenders. You do valuation for lenders. What does that look like? What's involved with the work product there that you're kicking out? And how do you advise them similarly?
Working valuations for lenders involves typically three types of reports. One of them would be an out-and-out valuation of either the stock or the debt being sold. And we do value debt. People don't understand because they're not familiar with it, but debt is never worth the face value of that note or the promissory note. It may be carried at that value because the accountants don't mark it to market, but we'll do valuations of either equity or debt. The second form of activity that we have for lenders is we may provide a financial fairness opinion, where we look at the terms of the transactions, all of the ins and outs, all of the features, all of the reps and warrants, the bucket list, how deep it is, what the splashback can be for claims and warranties, and we'll determine if that's financially fair, meaning that the buyer is going to get the return they expected and that the seller has earned a market value for the interest sold. The last thing that they may ask, the bank may ask a valuation expert for help with, is to prepare a solvency opinion. And I would like to talk about that just a little bit more.
Please, please.
One of the things that has popped up, you know, since I was young and now that I'm not, is that it's very typical for a business to sell and have no more than 20% of that sale price be hard assets, meaning the rest of the sales price is blue sky or intellectual property. So one of the things that happens is let's just say a company is sold for 100. Banks love to lend against hard assets, accounts receivable, inventory, real estate. Banks get all over that. But what if you need a $40 million loan on that $20 million asset base? Well, in that case, there has to be some intangible assets there. Typically, if a company follows generally accepted accounting practices, they're required to recognize intangible assets on their balance sheet at the time they're sold. We may do an intangible asset valuation. We may do a purchase price allocation. We may also value personal goodwill. But a bank can't lend 40 on an asset base of 20. They have to provide some other asset.
Right.
And it's up to us to provide information on what the market value of the intangible asset is, and then develop a solvency opinion based upon the expected cash flows for the assets, including the intangible assets. And it seems a little hocus pocus, but it is not. And it's something that's very common for us to prepare for banks. And sellers don't understand this. You know, sellers don't sell their $100 million company every day.
Right.
So again, it's incumbent upon us to make sure that we talk with the sellers and just set some expectations, and that we talk with the buyers and decide who's on first.
A typical engagement, sell side, how long does it take?
Normally, I'd expect 6 months.
How about buy side?
On the buy side, it's going to be a little quicker if they have professional due diligence. Right now, due diligence is being done virtual. It used to be that if you hired a CPA firm to do your due diligence as a buyer, that they would physically go to the facilities, tour them, physically examine inventory, confirm accounts receivable, check the quality of earnings, and develop a balance sheet that was appropriate for the intended use of the buyer. Well, due diligence isn't done in person anymore, and I miss those days. It's always fun flying around, looking at other people's stuff, but it's all done virtual now.
Right.
So the deal is, if your professionals can get along with the sellers on Zoom or any other video conferencing, if they're on time, if they can talk, if they can develop a rapport,
right,
then the close goes pretty fast. And typically I'm seeing 90 days, maybe 120 days.
Let me ask you to get into experiences. Obviously, we want to either change the names to protect the innocent or not bring up names at all. But it would be fun if we could talk about some of the interesting stories that you've had as a valuation professional in seeing things go, you know, both successes and failures or challenges, however you'd want to look at it. Is there anything that comes to mind that you could share that I think the audience might find either interesting, unusual, or something that they could learn from? Is that a fair question or series of questions?
Dave, you sound like you're doing cross in a litigation.
Again, my apologies. My litigation abilities are lacking anymore, but please.
At this point, I'd ask you to repeat the question. But
absolutely.
Let's assume I don't ask that right now, Dave.
Okay. Thank you. Much appreciated.
What was the question? In 2005, there was a company that attracted private equity investment, and they did it in two separate rounds. They put in a relatively complex system of preferred stock for each of the investor rounds. Mm-hmm. The investors were East Coasters, but the company was here in Missouri. The company had significant value. Its auditor was Deloitte, so it did have GAAP financial statements. They were reliable and consistent. It had competent financial administration, which does matter. Mm-hmm. I can't tell you how many entrepreneurs mm-hmm. that, oh, we can just get a controller for, you know, $60,000 and they'll be happy and all my needs will be met. Well, I have to tell you that that's not true. And that's not market for top talent in financial administration.
Correct.
Even in Kansas City. But I hear that all the time. And then you go look at their records and they're dismal. Well, this company, between the time the investment rounds came in 06 and to 2013, increased in size 5 times.
Mm, wow.
It increased in cash flow 8 times. Obviously, there were some very successful owners. The owner at that time still had control of the board, but he wanted to monetize some of his wealth, wanted to upgrade his Ferraris. At that time, I think it was a 348. red, of course.
Of course, yes.
And so they brought in a larger private equity investment company. And between that time and 2018, the company had a tenfold increase in revenue and a 20-fold increase in bottom line cash flow.
Wow.
At that time, we're talking about a company that was started with an investment of $13 million that had a value of well over $2 billion. The company had almost no capital investment. It had no trouble attracting employees because they had interesting doggone jobs. It wasn't Cerner, although Cerner is an interesting case to talk about too. And in that second round where they had the tenfold revenue increase, 20-fold cash flow increase, the owner no longer had control of the company.
Mm, right.
And the reason I want to bring this up is because owners cringe at the idea that anybody else would have control of their company. This owner became a billionaire without control of his original $13 million company. That's nice.
It's unheard of.
It is in the Kansas. It's unusual in the Kansas City market.
Yeah, unusual.
Although we can name 4 or 5 that we've all read about in the Kansas City Business Journal. And truly, I mean, when Cliff and Neil started Cerner after they left Arthur Andersen in 86, I think it was, you know, I don't think they thought they had a $30 billion company. Now, Oracle's going to come in. They'll change everything. And again, I go back to a seller's mentality. Sellers are not good middle managers. So when we work with sellers, we try to explain to them, get yours first and get out.
Right.
It doesn't matter how smart you are or how much you can continue to grow a company. The other thing we talk with sellers about is the best asset they can sell is growth. It used to be, particularly in the early 2000s, before the dot-com bust, that people would buy companies and close them just to eliminate competition.
I'd forgotten about that. That's a good recollection. Yeah.
Well, those days are gone. The reason right. a public company or a non-public company or a private equity investor group buys a company now is because it's cheaper to buy your growth than it is for them to internally, organically grow growth. Now, everybody talks about growth. You know, it's this nebulous, intangible thing. You know, well, we're growing really fast. You know, we're growing 50% a year and we're going to keep doing that forever. No, you won't. Because if you did, you'd take over the world. What will happen is that you'll enjoy explosive growth until somebody comes up with a cheaper method to provide the same good or service.
Or your special asset goes off patent.
Well, and what's big growth right now? Lithium batteries for cars and vehicles, and then all the services and supplies related to them. What's not big growth is anybody that was reliant on Cerner.
Good call.
You know, and it's just that simple. Things come and grow every doggone day. And so owners have to have a degree of nimbleness. They do not have a crystal ball that works well. They do have the hubris of knowing that they've been awfully successful, and they can go to the country club and talk about how successful they've been. But helping them bank that success,
it's a whole nother
thing, is as much psychological as it is a mathematical issue.
And for those folks, because the podcast goes out across the nation, a lot of people might know who Cerner is, but Cerner is a very unique company that develops software used primarily, if not exclusively, in the medical profession. And they've had fantastic growth here in Kansas City. But boy, one of the owners, Neil Patterson, died. The other principal owners, I should say, founders, Cliff Illick, is retired in essence, and they've sold out to Oracle. So we have a transition going on here in Kansas City, as we did a few years ago when Sprint was acquired by T-Mobile. So just give a little background for those folks. Okay, here's an out in left field question for you. What do attorneys do right? What do attorneys do wrong in the M&A process from your vantage point?
When there's a valuation issue, if attorneys would take the time to listen to the valuation expert, I think that would be helpful. And I want to explain a little bit more.
Please.
In my experience, it's very common to come into the attorney's office or into a conference room with four or five attorneys, and they all say, we would like a value of 200. Well, isn't that nice? Could I see some financial statements, tax returns, past distributions to owners, the capital structure, the debt structure, and a five-year forecast? I think it's helpful if attorneys strive, even in litigation, to keep their valuation expert as independent as you can. And I have to tell you that attorneys know this, but there is no email, no file note, nothing in my files that I can protect from subpoena.
Correct.
And Missouri Absolutely. Is an accountant privileged state. But for me to invoke that privilege, mm-hmm. I have to hire my own attorney. And the cost just skyrockets.
Yes.
I have had that happen where people have been overbearing. You know, I now learn to give the client a lecture. Don't put things on email. Don't ever talk about your valuation expectation in writing. There's a reason God gave us feet and a mouth. Not just a mouth. Get together in person, chit-chat about it a little bit, but let your valuation expert be independent. Don't put things in an email like, well, they've got $15 million excess working capital. That'll be added to the value. Oh, my God. If I have to explain that in a deposition or in a witness chair, attorney, you're in trouble because your client's going to ask why my bill was $300,000 or $400,000. Instead of the estimated price of whatever, $25,000, $30,000. So that's my deal with attorneys. I will tell you, the most common contact we get from attorneys calling us looking for a result one way or the other is in divorce work.
Okay.
And we try not to do divorce work, but we will do divorce work. The second most common type of litigation where we get asked and there's an expectation of value is where an employee or some other party has committed embezzlement.
Right.
Or there's an insurance loss that the insurance company prefers not to cover. And then the third type of litigation, of course, is every seller thinks they got too little. Every buyer thinks they paid too much. So, you know, I will tell you, people are heightened. Their hands are closer to the button on going nuke when they're upset. The economy has spooked everybody, no matter how wealthy, and it has become really problematic in some cases.
This podcast is going out to the public in early 2023, okay? What do you predict for 2023 sitting here now? What do you think M&A is going to look like next year? The midterms are done, right? And, you know, I don't know where we're going to be with Ukraine. Nobody does. Nobody knows where we're going to be with supply chain. Banks, you know, probably will be again raising their interest rate. They don't want to. They don't have a choice because it costs. They've got to buy money as well. Inflation is running rampant. Do you want to prognosticate a little bit to see what are your thoughts about 2023?
Well, we already have, you know, maybe approximately 120 clients set up for 2023.
Wow.
And so we have substantial commitment, if you will, to be independent valuation experts, at least of those clients. Here's what we see. The Tax Cuts and Jobs Act of 17 expires at the end of 25.
Right.
People are going to take great pains to try to get their estates distributed while the estate and lifetime gifting credit is at 12 million plus. And we see a lot of that.
Agreed.
We also know, sadly, that us baby boomers are dying. And so we see a substantial number of estates with big wealth. You know, I mean, big wealth oftentimes is invested in successful entrepreneurial, privately held investments. The third thing we see, and this has been a nasty for our clients, is that valuation multiples are down.
Agreed.
You know, when things were really hot, you know, say 16, 17, 18, people were paying a stretch value. You know, if a manufacturing company was worth six, just because of bidding and an overflow of available investor cash, that business could get bid up to 8 to 9 range. Well, now that business, that if everything was normal and was at historical long values, would be worth 6, it's dropped to 5. And that's a lot.
That is a lot.
And so if you've got a company that's throwing off cash flow of 5 million a year and it's worth 6, then that might indicate the value is 30 plus cash and receivables, which may put them nearer to 40. Well, now all of a sudden that business is worth 25, and it's a much more measured process to get that deal done. So I expect those three things to happen: death, taxes, and declining multiples.
That's good. How I have not asked you this question, but how have you dealt with, or how much significance have you given to any of your valuations, the effect that inflation has had over the last year and a half or so?
Inflation isn't our first seat driver.
Right.
Availability of material is.
Got it.
And inflation has made availability of material hard. For instance, lithium for lithium batteries. But even more commodity type things have become hard to get.
Correct.
State of Missouri is a huge producer of pet food, and pet food has been unavailable at many retail outlets. And it's getting more equilibrium now. But for a while, pet food was so hard to get that they're feeding people food to their pets. And you say, well, you know, it's no big deal. Well, you know, the last time a pet food plant sold, it sold for over $300 million. And I don't know about the other entrepreneurs, but if I had a business interest worth $300 million, I'd be interested in protecting it.
Yes, so, absolutely. Good call.
And, you know, we've had to stock outs with paper products for consumers.
Right.
We've had to stock out in pork. We now have California saying they won't allow pork imported into the state unless the pig has been able, the hog can walk around before they're slaughtered. Well, these are big things.
Yes, they are.
You know, and you look at the ESG responsibilities. There are some politicians putting pressure on saying you can't do it. Well, the truth is you can do it. And in the long run, it's going to be an expectation of people. And if you don't have environmental, social, and governance controls in place, it will reduce value as well.
Yes. In the eyes of that ultimate investor and or buyer. Absolutely.
Investor doesn't want to buy liabilities that aren't on the books.
Right.
They don't mind taking liabilities they're told about, but they don't want to take liabilities they're not told about. So what I see is supply chain is really causing certain industries great deal problems. Industries that manufacture electronics right now seem to be back on their feet. Chip manufacturers, though, are, you know, we've ramped up production, and now all of a sudden they're saying they have excess product.
Oh, wow.
And, you know, that's just the American way. You know, we have pendulums.
Swings back and forth.
We have big demand for oil and gas. Prices are up. Prices haven't been up since 2014. Oil and gas went through 8 years of brutal losses, reduced reserve reports, and inability to get money to invest in wells and exploration. Well, now the prices are way up, but nobody wants to invest in capital expenditures in oil and gas. And one wonders why that would be. Well, they just came through a brutal 8-year spanking. You know, how many industries does oil and gas touch? Everyone.
Yeah, all. It's that volatility component that scares people.
So the way we reflect excess price risk is through adjusting expectations for volatility. Where if we looked at a particular company, say in 2018, and maybe its volatility was in the neighborhood of 30%, we're now seeing those same companies have volatility closer to 70%. Exact same companies, and it's purely because of supply, demand, out of stock, the war in Ukraine, the refugee problem. The immigrant problem is putting pressure on a lot of businesses because the immigrants are necessary to run some of these businesses that we all rely on. And so, you know, here we go, the pendulum swinging. I can only hope I retire soon enough that I don't have to worry about it and stay awake at night.
Well, I hope not. I hope you don't retire anytime soon. Let me ask you, kind of wrap this up in a open-ended question. Based upon your experiences, what are the 2 to 3 pieces of advice you would give to someone interested in transitioning their business?
Make a decision to get an outside expert to review your financial statements and your financial administration policies. Clean that up before you put your company up for sale. There are several pitfalls that can be found during that review. One of them is you could be administrating your benefits incorrectly and expecting a buyer to take a big liability. And buyers are more savvy than that. Don't let the buyer come back and tell you you're not administrating your 401k plan correctly. The number two thing is consider how you title the assets of the company. I can't tell you how many people have 2 or 3 different leasing companies outside of their operating company. They may be leasing real estate, warehouse space, a fleet of trucks, a fleet of cars. They may be leasing computer equipment or stuff like that. And eventually you have to decide what your unit of measure is on what you're going to sell.
Right.
And we all know why owners and entrepreneurs would do that. It's because they had tax advice somewhere along the way saying they could better control their cost of taxes by doing that. And at some point, those owners, those boards of directors, have to stop doing things for tax minimization, have to start doing things for value maximization. Then the last thing, and this is, owners struggle with this, and boards of directors will bite my head off for this, but don't wait until you're forced to sell. We consider valuation reports that we write a celebration of somebody's life's work. And that's truly what they are. If you're forced to sell, buyers are pretty sharp and they have good representation too. You're not going to be able to book the same value you could if you sold it when there was no outside force forcing you to sell.
Once again, a brilliant teaching opportunity with multiple lessons. I want to thank Steve And once again, it's like every time I talk to you, I learn something. I thank you personally. I know the listeners will be very excited. How can they find you, Steve? Can you give us your contact information?
The easiest way to get in touch with me is just to look up Stern Brothers Valuation Advisors on any search engine. If not that, Business Valuation will pull us up, top two or three. And we do operate coast to coast. I have reports written in Chinese, French, German. So we, by the way, as an aside, foreign investment in the U.S. is just about froze off.
Yes.
It's just about stopped entirely. But just look us up on a search net. My email is so simple, it hurts. It's just York, like the family that should be the king of England, but they're not. YORK at Stern, STERN, and then B as in boy, V as in Victor, .com.
Thanks again to Steve. I really appreciate him. I know that everyone listening in will just find him to be fun and utterly fascinating. He is not like any other valuation expert you've ever dealt with, and that is a positive statement, much like I am not like any other attorney that you've ever met. If you're in search of assistance with any of these issues we've talked about, please reach out to Steve or contact me at www.davesider.com. With me, you can schedule a free consultation. Please make sure as well to subscribe to the show, rate it, and leave me a comment on your favorite podcast platform such as Spotify or Apple Podcasts. I thank you all. We look forward to talking to you again soon. This podcast is provided for educational purposes. It does not constitute legal advice and is not intended to establish an attorney-client relationship. The recommendations contained in this podcast are not necessarily appropriate for every individual or every business. In determining the best course of action, please, as a business owner or an interested buyer, please consult with an attorney on their individual and distinct circumstances.